ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's alliance with the United States has been the linchpin of our country's foreign policy for decades.
We value the unbroken friendship between the Australian and the American peoples.
But between the wars and the tariffs and the unpredictability, are we growing apart?
You know who else didn't help us? Australia.
Join me, Hamish McDonald.
And me, Geraldine Doogue, as we ask, do we still need the alliance? Search for Global Roaming on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Inflation, debt, rising interest rates, an AI boom or bubble. The global financial system is straining under pressure, and a lot of smart people are warning that it may break. One of those people is Suchajit Das. He spent around half a century working in some of the world's biggest banks, as well as in major international corporations. Before the global financial crisis erupted in 2008, he was one of the few people who issued warnings saying that it was coming. That caused Bloomberg to name him as one of the 50 most influential thinkers in finance back in 2014. Now he thinks another crisis is on the way. So, what's going to break first? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Michael Yander, the ABC's business editor, keeping the chair warm for Carrington Clark while he's on another overseas adventure. And we've got something special lined up for your Monday. We're going to spend this episode chatting with Suchajit Das, looking at the two biggest pressure points that he sees in the financial system right now. First, bonds, debt, and rising interest rates, and second, the interconnected boom in AI investment. Das, thank you for joining ABC Business Daily.
It's good to be with you.
I've known you for quite a long time. In fact, since I started working at the ABC in 2008, we were introduced by economics correspondent Stephen Long while we were covering the fallout from the global financial crisis and trying to explain to people why some obscure financial instruments connected to US mortgages had almost blown up the global banking system and the economy with it. Now, you'd seen that disaster coming as early as a couple of years before and warned about it. I'm pretty worried that you're getting pretty worried that we're heading for something similar. Are we heading for GFC 2.0?
Well, I think Mark Twain said that history never repeats, it rhymes. But there are some very, very ominous similarities, like different complex structures, high levels of debt. And as you will recall, it's rises in interest rates which triggered the problems in 2007, 2008. So the similarities are there.
Yeah, so the underlying issues were sitting there, and it was the rise in interest rates that, as Warren Buffett said, exposed who'd been swimming naked, if you like. And one of these pressure points this time seems to be in the bond market, where countries since that global financial crisis have been used to borrowing very cheaply. But now you and others have warned about the possibility of what's been called by some Bondmageddon. It sounds pretty apocalyptic. How close do you think we might be?
Well, I think the interesting thing here is that rates have gone up, but they haven't gone up that much. They've gone up about 0.5%, give or take. And that's in the US, in Japan, in the UK, Germany, France, and in Australia. I think there are two significant things about that. One is we haven't seen these types of rates for a very long time. In the case of the US, we have to go back to around 2000 or even earlier. And in the case of Australia, we're back to sort of the levels of 2011. So it's a very significant shift from what you were saying, which is the really low rates that we've had. And the second thing that people forget is the amount of debt that we have now is exponentially higher. So even a small rise in interest rate can be significant in terms of your interest cost. And you're quite correct, as you were saying earlier, rising interest rates have a habit of ending booms. They did it in 1987, they did it in 1994, they did it in 2000, they did it in 2008.
So as you say, Das, it's not that interest rates have surged particularly this year, or even that in a broader historical sweep, we're certainly not talking, you know, the interest rates we saw at the end of the 1980s that resulted in stock market crashes and the early 90s recession. But it does seem like both corporations, households, governments, we've all become addicted to ultra-low interest rates.
I think that's right, because essentially, I think we've had a series of events. Firstly, inflation came down massively from the 1980s, and we've lived in that low inflation period. The second reason is that we've had a series of events like the GFC itself, then we've had the European debt crisis, then we've had the COVID-19 pandemic. All of that was addressed by governments by low interest rates, among other measures, of course. And that means that people, there's a whole generation really, who have never seen interest rates this high. And I think they're having to adapt to this environment, and it's not easy.
We've, of course, seen President Trump in the US trying to appoint a Fed chair who would lower interest rates. When that doesn't seem to work, he's now most recently threatening and trying to strong arm the US Federal Reserve into lowering interest rates when it actually looks more likely that they might raise them later this month. They've also tried to push long-term interest rates down by issuing short-term US treasuries. From Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary. I mean, none of these seem particularly sustainable ways to keep, you know, to get interest rates back down to that ultra low level that President Trump seems to want.
Well, I think the last time somebody actually asked him about bond deals, he said that he would basically send in the military. So I think given that his two favorite things that he does, one is tariffs and the other is wars. So we'll have to see how we go. But the reality is, interest rates are being driven now by primarily by inflation. And the big thing is higher energy prices driven by the Middle East conflict. And I'm always amused by the fact that everybody thinks oil costs $90 per barrel for, say, Brent crude. This is completely misleading due to the higher refining cost. Diesel prices are the equivalent of $100 more than that. It's around $190 per barrel. And we haven't actually seen the full flow through of energy prices into things like fertilizers, industrial chemicals, plastics, polyester. And we won't really see the effects of all of this on inflation probably till sometime in 2027. And there's a whole bunch of other things going on in the background. One is we have disruption to food supplies because of the Ukraine conflict. And basically, we also have massive rises in shipping costs around the world and from climate change. Climate change obviously affects food as well, but the Danube levels and the Rhine River levels are low, which is interrupting transport. The actual water levels in Lake Gatun and the Panama Canal are down, and the costs have gone through the roof. And people are totally focused on the oil price, but these things are running in parallel. And I also believe that people have lost sight of the fact that there's a parallel economic war going on, which is President Trump's much beloved tariffs, all the trade restrictions, all the assets.
And the need to bring manufacturing back onshore for national security reasons, like the US not being able to rely on just buying, you know, cheap rare earths or other goods out of China.
Absolutely. And that's going to push up the costs. And there might be very good reasons for sovereignty and economic and security independence and domestic employment to go down those paths, but they will come with a cost. And essentially, that's going to drive inflation. And we're going to talk about AI in a second, but the AI boom has driven up things like the cost of chips, of memory, and they're up fivefold over the last year. And that's going to actually feed through into consumer prices. And parallel to that, you have governments who are essentially in now what I call in a state of perpetual deficit. The US budget deficit is 6%, and the average fiscal deficit in the OECD countries is just under 5%. And so essentially, there's this massive supply of debt from governments coming at the same time as these inflationary pressures. So it's hardly surprising that you're going to keep getting pressure. And I think one of the interesting things is the stress points. The US, because it's the largest economy in the world still, is one of those pressure points, if you like. But there is other ones as well. France, Italy, Britain, Japan, all of these are heavily indebted countries with stagnant economies and very deep structural problems, and in some cases with growing political strains. And their credit quality is going down. So I think you've got a supply problem, and at the same time, you have a demand problem. Because essentially, where the money was coming from for a lot of this debt is actually two tiny pockets of the world. One is Northern Europe, and the other one is the petrostates and the East Asian economies. And they're all divesting from government bonds. And the US is reliant on foreign capital to the tune of about 30%. 30% of its government debt is owned by foreigners. They live on the kindness of strangers. And you're going to see a massive rejigging of the demand for these types of securities and this type of debt. And all of these pressures mean that interest rates aren't likely to go down anytime soon.
So what do you think will happen here with this feedback loop of increasing interest costs, given that you don't see any pressures towards lower interest rates in the near term at least? Is this the cause of the next financial crisis?
Well, it'll be part of it, because essentially government rates are the bedrock of all cost of borrowing, all capital costs within the economy. So what you're going to find is households and businesses will have to cut back spending and investment, and the overstretched will slide into financial distress. And that'll inflict losses on banks and private lenders, which have obviously proliferated over the last few years. And you're starting to see that already. I mean, in the US, one measure that I always look at is actually auto loans. Because in America, as you know, the last thing you want to give up, I mean, you're willing to give up your house, you're willing to give up your wife, you're willing to give up your children. The one thing you won't give up is your car. But those actual loan delinquency rates are now at levels that we haven't seen since 2007, 2008. So that's going to happen. And governments, at a minimum, are going to have to somehow manage their spending. So effectively, if their money is going to pay interest, there's only two options. One is they have to cut back on other spending, or they're going to have to print money. And if they print money, that creates inflation, and that's going to create a different kind of feedback loop. And people forget that there's a massive stock of government debt and debt around the world, which is the flip side to the fact that people have borrowed. And higher rates will, and defaults for that matter, will result in losses on existing holdings for any investor. And interestingly enough, central banks, because of quantitative easing, own a lot of these bonds. And I actually had a look earlier this year. The US Federal Reserve has unrealized losses on its holding of US government debt of just under $1 trillion. And that's obviously going to be higher now because the interest rates have gone up. And globally, the losses are 4 to 5 times that amount. And so that's the one side of the equation. And the other side is we all know that asset prices around the world are overstretched, whether it's shares, whether it's properties. In fact, if it's art, it's all overstretched. And as interest rates move up and you discount back those cash flows to today, clearly you're going to have to adjust in some way. And essentially, that is the process by which all crises start. And that is the trajectory we are on. And I see no reason that that's going to change in the near term.
Interesting you mention overvaluation and, you know, high valuations. Of course, the center of that, at least as far as share markets are concerned, is AI, AI-related companies, the boom on Wall Street that is so heavily concentrated in those companies, the hyperscalers linked to the artificial intelligence rollout. To some extent, people see it as being a road to utopia. Increasing productivity may be the factor that actually puts downward pressure on inflation and allows interest rates to fall back if the AI boom works out as its proponents advocate. On the other hand, some people just don't see the business case stacking up for the sheer amount of investment that's going into it. Let's start first with the tech. Do you think, given how much money has been sunk into this and the valuations that are attached, that it will ever generate a financially viable return?
Well, before we get to the return, I think you have to go back to the base technology. Strangely enough, I have a greater familiarity with AI than I ever assumed I did, because in the 1980s, I worked on things like neural networks and rule-based expert systems. And over the years, I've worked on things like big data, pattern recognition, machine learning algorithms, all of which are part of AI. And all of those technologies, sadly, didn't ever live up to their promise. And there is really only one thing that's new, which is basically large learning models, which are really massive data sets to create text and imagery. But there's a whole series of issues on the technology. One is the data. Where's the data coming from? Now, the hyperscalers, for instance, the Googles of the world, the Metas of this world, essentially have a lot of data. Because remember the old saying that if you don't know what the product is, you are the product in terms of social media. And they've got a lot of data that they can actually use. They're scraping data from every website they can find. But there's a whole lot of issues around authority, access, compensation, privacy, which we're basically dealing with. The other thing is the data sets are always incomplete. And what we're now seeing is that as AI generates data, AI is basically relying on AI-generated data. And there's some celebrated fiascos, including law firms, which have been chided by judges because they were citing precedents which don't exist, regulations and laws that don't exist. So essentially, what I can tell you about the technology is it's still very, very much something which is a work in progress. It might get better, I don't know. But at the moment, it's adapted interpolating answers if there is data around it, but it can't extrapolate. And anything which is novel or the environment is dynamic, it's failing. What it's taking over is lower level tasks. So that becomes a question of whether you can make money and a reasonable level of investment, return on investment. But the interesting thing is you're spending something like $7 trillion. And I did just a simple calculation. The most successful piece of software that I'm aware of is Microsoft's Windows and Office Suite. That generates less than $100 billion per annum. And by my calculation, you need to generate somewhere between $2 and $5 trillion per annum to earn an adequate return on this. And I'm struggling, Michael. I'm really struggling to see where that's going to come back. And that's assuming we can go down this trajectory. And there's all these other risks like water, electricity supply costs, competition, because the OpenAI and Anthropic proprietary models are being challenged by China's public open source models. The cost of tokens are following. And there's massive regulatory pressure. People are putting in place regulations. I don't know how that's going to affect the revenues.
In terms of this, though, the expansion continues apace. And one of the areas that is generating a lot of concern, including one that you've raised, is the circularity of the financing. It gets pretty complicated, but in simple terms, can you run us quickly through how a company, for instance, such as NVIDIA or Oracle, are basically funding their own business and expansion?
Well, I think there's three elements. There's cross-shareholdings, and there's vendor financing and reciprocal transactions. So if NVIDIA sells chips to somebody, frequently what they do is they don't get paid for it. What they're doing is basically investing in the purchaser of the chips. Now, this has some really weird accounting implications. So NVIDIA recognizes the income upfront from the sales, but the investment shows up as an asset on its balance sheet. And it's quite amusing as well. Then what NVIDIA does is they occasionally write up these investments. So if you actually look at all the hyperscalers, their profits in the last quarter were very, very good. But if you actually strip down below that, about $160 billion of that came from markups of these valuations. And there are a whole lot of issues around buyer depreciation rates, the real-life obsolescence of these chips, And a lot of this financing is not showing up on people's balance sheets as yet.
So it's not traditional debt. It's like what governments have been doing by shuffling asset investments off balance sheet. You're saying these companies are doing something akin in the corporate world. So what happens here if the music stops and confidence goes and all the valuations of these private companies like OpenAI, like Anthropic, like what we've seen with SpaceX once it did hit the market and now has a daily updated valuation? What does that mean for this whole funding model?
Well, I don't really know what it means, but I do think it's not going to end well, because essentially everything flows back into a few firms like OpenAI and Anthropic, which have to finance these investments. So it's a massive bet on massive revenues coming into these companies, which they can use to fund their obligations going forward. And I think it'll play out slowly. And I think that's why we don't have the crash now. But I think over the next 18 months to 2 years, there will be what I would call disappointment. People are going to say, well, nothing's really happening. And you're going to see the balance sheets of these hyperscalers show massive amounts of increases in debt. And that's when the disillusionment and the comeuppance is going to come.
Now, if it is the greatest financial delusion, just how big is it? How does it compare to previous bubbles we've seen? And what do you think is the end game if it does start falling over?
The only way we can really look at it is the amount of investment that's gone into it. It's about 17 times the dot-com boom and about 4 times the 2008 subprime housing bubble when we met. And essentially, what we now find is that if that investment on that scale disappoints and that has to be written off, it's essentially going to wipe out a lot of values. And one of the things about this period of history that we've lived through is that nobody's actually received cash for any of the investments, which theoretically have gone up in value. So you're suddenly going to lose all this wealth on a massive scale, which we've never seen before.
So far, it's all paper wealth. And as The Economist pointed out recently, it's a lot of it's being funded by cash flows. And the people who'll be wiped out are NVIDIA shareholders or Oracle shareholders. So does it matter for the rest of the financial system? Will it be different from 2008 and the financial crisis?
Well, if NVIDIA gets wiped out, if Google, Meta and Microsoft and all these companies are badly affected, the question that I have is that's like 20-30% of the stock market. And effectively, that money is not simple money. It's money from superannuation funds. It's money from private investors. It's money from insurance companies. And that's a massive loss of real wealth that people have assumed. And in many cases, people have borrowed massively against. So that is the magnitude of the problem we are looking at. And no matter what anybody says, at the end of the day, cash matters. Cash is everything. And there is no cash here. And what cash was invested will be lost on a massive scale. I was joking with a friend of mine the other day that he was worrying because he's getting close to retirement, where his superannuation funds have invested. I said, well, you may not know it, but basically your entire retirement depends on NVIDIA.
And is that how it affects us here in Australia, that this is where 5, 10, 15, 20% of our superannuation funds are sitting?
Well, I think the Australian superannuation fund's fascinating because they have a very high allocation to private assets, which is like 20, 30%. So that's one of the channels through which anything that goes wrong overseas will flow in. But the other thing is, people forget that our financial system is deeply interconnected. So the problems that will go on there will affect us in a major way. I'll give you a simple example. We've seen the valuations of companies like Atlassian and Canva get written down in recent months. And that's a direct flow on from what's actually happening. So we won't be immune. And if the financial problems flow through into the real economy, then the reduction in export demand for our products and higher costs of things will flow through. And at the moment, you know, it's kind of an interesting process because everybody is sort of into FOMO, fear of missing out. And they talk about FEMO, fabulous earnings momentum, which is based, as I always joke, on EBITDA, earnings before Iran, tariffs, Donald and AI. And then there's TINA, there is no alternative. Eventually, it always ends in the same place. No go, need of getting out.
And when everyone wants to get out at the same time, that's when you have a financial crisis.
That's exactly right. And that's unavoidable. And I think at a deeper level, we have lived in this pseudo-reality for 20 years because we never resolved the problems of the GFC. We never did. And the science fiction writer Philip Dick once said, you know, we are bombarded with pseudo-realities. Reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, does not go away. And that is the moment that is now rapidly approaching.
Suchajit Das, thanks so much for sharing your time and knowledge with us.
It's my pleasure, Michael.
That's it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. We'll be back with another episode tomorrow. Make sure you're following on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to send a question, email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au.